From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from WUIS in Springfield, Illinois, as part of our election road trip. How the tariffs are hitting farmers here, coming up in a moment.
Looking forward to that. But first, where are we on Hurricane Florence, which has been swirling towards the Carolinas and Virginia, expected to make landfall on Thursday on the coast of the Carolinas? More than a million people have been ordered to evacuate. In South Carolina, some roads have already been reversed so that traffic can move only in one direction, away from the coast. Gavin Jackson is a reporter with the South Carolina ETV. And Gavin, South Carolina's governor, Henry McMaster, lifted the evacuation order for three counties, Jasper, Beaufort, and Culloden. He had given a mandatory evacuation order for the entire 187-mile coast of South Carolina. So why the switch?
So that mandatory evacuation order was supposed to take place at noon. It did for all those other counties, but the lower counties, those three that you listed, that was never implemented for those counties. So they were never having any lane reversals take place down there yet, yeah. And they were never under a mandatory evacuation order, whereas these other counties, other five counties that are going to experience some more of the effects of the hurricane are still under mandatory evacuations, and those lane reversals are taking place on those major highways for those areas.
Talk about the lane reversals. Are people prepared for this idea that you can only go one way and that's out?
Yeah, this is something that South Carolinians have faced before with Hurricane Matthew in 2016, and that was one of the first times we had done it in years, and it was successful then, and it's already up and flowing right now. I think they have they opened these lanes earlier than they expected so far because they were ready to do so, and I think it's a little bit of a shock at first. I think it takes some time to get the traffic going, but once it does go, it does flow, and it will be going for the main area of Charleston to Columbia and also areas from Myrtle Beach inland as well.
What about hospitals, nursing homes? What's happening there?
Yeah, they're also under evacuation order, too. They're relocating a lot of their patients that are in those evacuated areas that are under mandatory evacuation. So, again, they have these plans in place. They prepare for this pretty well, Robin. Mm. They drill for this stuff every year. They do tabletop exercises. The state officials do this. And they even do some drills when it comes to these lane reversals. So this is something that South Carolina has done, and they've experienced this before, specifically Hurricane Matthew. So as far as we can tell, as far as the governor's last press conference, things appear to be going smoothly with the medical facilities.
Well, you know, we talked to friends in Charleston, and they said it's a beautiful day, and people aren't really paying attention and not taking this in. What's your sense? Are people hearing the reports that this could be the worst hurricane strike since Hugo in 1989?
Yeah, and that's completely understandable because Charleston did see a lot of flooding last year from Irma, and a lot of people didn't take Irma too seriously either. A lot of that was more in Hilton Head, and I think a lot of people are thinking the same thing about this one, just because that track we keep seeing, that cone we keep seeing, is just so much more north of Charleston. So there's maybe not as much focus. But, of course, they keep saying, look outside of that cone. This storm is 400 miles wide. They still don't know exactly where it's going to hit. They keep talking about possibly hitting even landfall in South Carolina. So that could still obviously affect people in Charleston, and especially Charleston with its low-lying areas. It's prone to flooding.
Right.
On a bad storm day anyway, so it's
well, on a
maybe
sunny
a little
day,
worrisome that they're not doing that. Yeah,
yeah, they have sunny day flooding, we've learned. Well, and what about the surge aspect? It's one thing, the rainfall is going to be powerful, but surges, we've heard estimates from 12 to 20 feet of the seawater coming up over walls, getting into estuaries, getting into freshwater, and also just being deadly in its own force at the coast. What are people thinking about that?
Yeah, and I think that probably goes back to your prior point about Charleston. Again, they're not expected to see as high of a storm surge there as they are in other parts like Myrtle Beach and North Myrtle Beach, which is about 100 miles north of Charleston, that area. So, again, the focus is probably becoming more and more on the Grand Strand area. You might be familiar with the Low Country, which encompasses Charleston. The Grand Strand is north of that, which encompasses Myrtle Beach. And that's, I think, where a lot more focus is on that evacuation because they do evacuate up there for that kind of storm surge.
We're hearing that the reason this is happening is there's a ridge of high pressure, which is extreme, especially for this time of year. It's going to develop just off the coast of New England and shunt Florence, keep her down towards the southeast coast. And the strength of this ridge could be unprecedented in 30 years, according to some of the forecast models. Are people, you know, frightened or panicking or just taking everything in stride?
I think they're taking it in stride right now. We have obviously seen a lot of movement in the grocery stores and supplies and hardware stores, people boarding up. South Carolinians are aware of these threats. Like I said, Hurricane Matthew was probably the most recent memory that South Carolinians have besides that 1,000-year flood we had in 2015. And Matthew was in 2016. And Matthew brought about 12 to 17 inches of rain across the region. So I'm sure, I mean, we can already say that, and Matthew's on a Category 1 storm, whereas what we're looking at right now with Florence is Category 4. So people should definitely be taking that seriously. And I think the more that these tracks get refined and the more we get some rainfall total updates, predictions, I think that's going to really start hammering it home for a lot of people who might think that they can write it out, because that flooding is going to be severe. And we did see severe flooding from Matthew. A lot of that was obviously in North Carolina, but it came our way, and we still had a lot of those ramifications.
That's Gavin Jackson with South Carolina ETV. Gavin, thanks, and best of luck to you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, I'm here in Springfield, Illinois today, where agriculture is huge. The state leads the nation in soybean production, and President Trump's trade policies, including tariffs, are resonating because China responded with its own tariffs on things like soybeans, hurting U.S. exports. Robert Clem and his son farm around 1,100 acres, corn, soybeans, and a few cows in Waynesville, Illinois. He spoke to us this morning from his pickup truck.
Good morning.
And I can hear something in the background. What are you looking at right now?
We're working on grain bins, getting prepared to start harvest here later this week on corn. So we're just putting some finishing touches on preparing grain bins for storage.
So how are the tariffs impacting you right now?
I guess in my opinion, there's the number one, is the economics. They have taken between 20 and 25% off of our bean prices. They've taken probably a good 20% off of our corn prices. They've taken basically the profit level out. And then it's the uncertainty. Where not only is it hurting us now, but it's the uncertainty of where are we going from here? How long is this going to be? What's our trade partners thinking? We've spent 20 years developing these relationships and trade partnerships. When are we going to lose them? It's that uncertainty from our standpoint and their standpoint, I think, is the biggest issues.
How much do you sell to China?
Well, myself, I hardly none of my products actually go to China directly, because we sit here in central Illinois, very close to Decatur, Illinois, which is a large corn and soybean processing plant. Hardly none of ours goes directly to export seriously. But it's all tied together. Our product is still being exported to China. To give you an exact amount of corn and soybeans, I'm wanting to say it's like 25% of the beans or something like that. I just don't remember that exact percentage here right this moment. But a large percent of all beans raised in the U.S. go to China.
And so that is what's hitting you the most right now, is the uncertainty about the cost of that and the tariffs, right?
Yeah. It's just the cost of the tariffs and the lower commodity prices. And it's the corn and the beans are affecting me, but there's a lot of other products in the agricultural field that's hitting my fellow, so to speak, neighbors and fellow farmers. Pork industry, it's got hit very hard. We've developed a great market for pork. The Asian people have developed a good taste for pork and in their diet. We can take it, but they're not going to be able to pay for it. And so that is hurting them. If we're not going to raise the pork, that means there's going to be less corn fed to the pork and less soybean meal. So that comes back and hits me directly as well in the long
run. How long can you take this?
Well, I mean, that's a very difficult question to answer as well directly, because we'll take it probably as long as we've got to, because it's either that or quit producing. And we are a group of people who are made to produce a crop. We're made to produce it. Financially, it's taken a toll. There's some of us that have been in this business a lot more years, that are a little bit more established, that can stand it longer than what the young guys. It's, I'll call it the replacement generation that's coming in. They haven't got the reserves that we have, and it's going to be hurting them very, very significantly in the very near future, I'd say, within this year. It's already hurting them because, like I said, they got to go to the bank. They work on more borrowed operating capital than what some of the older established ones, farmers do. But it's still going to come to it's a pocketbook issue for each and every one of us.
Did you vote for Trump?
Yes, I did.
Would you vote for him again in 2020?
I would highly consider it. I don't know until I see what the options are. differently today than the competitors, so I don't know. It's a free market. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat per se. I'm a candidate evaluator on all issues, and so I can't say that specifically one way or the other.
What are you going to do in the upcoming midterm elections? Are you going to be voting for Democrats or Republicans?
Well, I'm going to be voting for the best candidate for the job. I don't necessarily say that I've got to be a Democrat or Republican. I look at
farmer in Waynesville, Illinois, also member of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, well, I've enjoyed having the opportunity to visit with you as well.
We're broadcasting from Springfield, Illinois today as part of our election road trip. It's a city devoted to maintaining the legacy of the nation's 16th president. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum is the centerpiece of the Lincoln sites here. I met state historian Sam Wheeler there.
Abraham Lincoln is certainly the most significant Illinoisan we've had in the last 200 years as we celebrate our bicentennial, and I will wager he will be the most significant Illinoisan for at least the next 200 years.
Why do you say that?
He's got such an inspiring life story from a log cabin, less than a year of formal education. He goes on to become president of the United States. He dies one of the most powerful men in the world. Why he's so significant? He saves the Union. Democracy itself hangs in the balance. He sees the war through to its end. And then, of course, American slavery ends on his watch. And we get to progress closer towards those ideals in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal.
So why did he abhor slavery when so many others at the time did not?
Abraham Lincoln, being anti-slavery, would have never called himself an abolitionist. There were two different things. An abolitionist calls for the immediate end of slavery and equal civil rights. Abraham Lincoln doesn't get there until very much later in his life. It's one of the ironies, one of the many ironies of American history. The man we know as the Great Emancipator wasn't an abolitionist. Now, by the end of his life, after the 13th Amendment, Mr. Lincoln is calling for some civil rights for African Americans.
Now, Lincoln was from Kentucky, but he spent much of his life in the state of Illinois. Do you think there was anything about Illinois that influenced his thinking and who he became?
Well, sure. He's born in Kentucky. He spends his adolescence in southern Indiana. Here in Illinois, he found a land that was full of opportunity. It allowed an individual like a young 20s Abraham Lincoln, without a great education, without folks that were prominent individuals advocating for him. And in Little New Salem, they propped an individual like that up, and they let him run for the Illinois legislature. And he won for consecutive terms to the Illinois legislature. Now, I would challenge you to say if Abraham Lincoln called New York State home, if those same opportunities would have been there.
Why?
Well, because it's a more established state with much more educated folks, much more accomplished folks. There's an infrastructure there that help young men with opportunity rise that wouldn't have been open to Abraham Lincoln. And so Illinois is a key ingredient in the mixture that makes up Abraham Lincoln.
Lincoln had his critics, and the museum lets you hear them. Sam Wheeler took us into the museum's whispering gallery.
Abraham Lincoln was born ignorant, and he's been losing ground ever since.
He certainly would have heard a lot of those criticisms of him. He also would have been aware of these political cartoons, and on occasion, he would show people political cartoons that were very negative towards him.
We're looking at one right here of Lincoln as a monkey holding a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation.
He's often portrayed in the press as a monkey, a gorilla. I mean, remember the time period that we're talking about. This is Darwin's Origin of Species era, right? And so to portray Abraham Lincoln as not a fully developed human being, his critics would use that metaphor to criticize him as not an effective leader.
A man who portrays President Lincoln for a living can occasionally be found right here at the Lincoln Presidential Library.
My name's Randy Duncan, and I'm a Lincoln presenter from Central Illinois.
Lincoln presenter.
The word impersonator, although it's commonly used, and I suppose I would answer to that, it has connotations that doesn't really work for somebody who's trying to do a serious job.
Now, our listeners cannot see you right now, but you look like Abe Lincoln. You've got the beard, you've got the bow tie on, the three-piece suit, the whole thing.
Well, thank you. That's the starting point. If you don't at least have the appearance, or at least a general appearance, people would not accept anything else that you have to say.
And that's a real beard. That's your real beard.
Yeah, mine is. Yeah, it kind of grows on you after a while.
But also that means that when you're not in character, you've still got the Abraham Lincoln beard with no mustache.
Yeah, that's right. And that is sometimes a bit of a challenge because, you know, from the neck up, you look pretty much the same all the time, whether it's blue jeans and a T-shirt or a black three-piece suit like this is.
So how did you get started doing this?
A friend of mine was running a business and was having a special event and wanted me to dress up in an outfit. He wasn't specific, just any outfit, just to make it a more festive event. And I'd been thinking about this. I had a full beard at the time, so I shaved off the top half of the beard and borrowed a top hat from the local high school theater group and put on a dark suit and a tie. And that's where it started.
How long ago was that?
That was this fall, which is about now. It would be 21 years ago.
21 years ago.
Yeah, and to be from Illinois means that you probably know some things about Lincoln already, as most people do. But then you have to go and become serious about it and become a sort of an amateur historian and to learn the things that a lot of people don't know to kind of flesh out the character. A lot of people know that Lincoln saved the Union and freed the slaves. He died in a theater. He was 6'4", the 16th president of the United States. You know, that's kind of a package that a large part of the population already knows. But there are things about Lincoln that a lot of people don't know.
What are the things that people don't know about Lincoln?
One of the most interesting things to me is his sense of humor. You look at a picture of a person, and of course at that time nobody smiled in pictures. Partly because of the long exposure time, and if you wiggled at all, you would have a blurry picture. So people think that everybody from that period was—they looked like they all had bunions, you know, and that were hurting them. They weren't smiling, but he was a funny man. People said at the time that no photograph ever really captured the way he was. So, for instance, he was going down the street one time with a fellow next to him. The report is that he saw a sign over a building. The proprietor's name for this business was T.R. Strong. And he saw the sign over the door, and he said, "Oh, that's right. T.R. Strong, but coffee are stronger."
So. Now, you have a deep voice, which is the way that we think of Abraham Lincoln. But what do we know about that? Because there are no recordings of him.
Right. It was a couple of decades before we had recordings available. But there are descriptions of Lincoln's voice, which was very much unlike mine. We think of anybody who we respect as having a deep, impressive voice, like a James Earl Jones voice, that kind of voice. But it was not at all the kind of voice he had. He had the descriptions report as kind of a high tenor voice, and they said even at that time that he would use old-fashioned pronunciations of things. And so you have to bring it up a notch from my natural voice up, and it would sound more like this, because he come from Kentucky, and you think about it, they have the kind of the bend the ends of the sentences up a little bit, and might say over thar instead of over there, and things like that. Or Mr. Chairman, I reckon, is how I could allow that.
I can't imagine the Gettysburg Address being said like that.
Well, that's all right. The one thing to remember is that a voice like that does carry a lot better in a big open area, which, of course, there was no amplification at that time. Excuse me, I'll get the voice back down. Once you get in, it's kind of odd to go in and out of it.
Can we have you give us a little bit of the Gettysburg Address?
Okay, I'll just do the first part of it. In Lincoln's voice, it would be, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
There must be some little kids who think that you actually are Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. I remember a fourth grade teacher told me about one of her students who came up to her afterwards and said, "Did he get kicked out of heaven so that he could be here with us today?" You know, they were at that age, those children were at that age where cognitively they knew that Abraham Lincoln was dead, and yet this guy looks so much like Lincoln that he probably is Lincoln. It is a humbling thing to be Lincoln. A week ago, there was a lady standing out there. This was after hours for the museum, standing there. And I just walked up. I didn't say anything. And she shook my hand, and she broke into tears.
Wow.
She was just so overcome with emotion at meeting President Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, I know that I'm not Abraham Lincoln, but for her purposes, I was a good enough stand-in. And so that is a very humbling thing to have that responsibility. He's not here, and none of his family are here, and I wouldn't want somebody to be representing me whenever I wasn't there to correct them. So it's not like a game, it's something to take seriously.
Lincoln presenter Randy Duncan left us to head to an elementary school where students had raised more than $18,000 in pennies to buy a book that was a testament to Lincoln's good moral character from the 1830s. It was needed for him to practice law in Illinois. That book will be donated to the Lincoln Museum.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Who deserves credit for the strong economy? President Trump tweeted a video yesterday. It starts with a clip from President Obama in 2016, raising doubts about then-candidate Trump's promises to bring back jobs to the U.S. Then the video cuts to this current sound from President Trump's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow.
More than 4 million jobs created since the election. Wages are growing at the fastest pace in nearly a decade. More Americans are now employed than ever before in the recorded history of our country. The list goes on and on.
New policies are working, all right? It may be the greatest story never told.
That's Kudlow there at the end. And that video came after President Obama defended his economic legacy last week at the University of Illinois.
By the time I left office, household income was near its all-time high. And the uninsured rate had hit an all-time low, and wages were rising, and poverty rates were falling. I mention all this just so when you hear how great the economy is doing right now, let's just remember when this recovery started.
And let's get some context. From Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also a co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey there.
So President Obama, we just heard, says the strong economy started under his watch. That's what we had been thinking. You know, economic experts had told us this is sort of an arc. But President Trump said in North Dakota last week it wasn't him and that the recovery under Obama was the weakest in history. True?
No, but I say that with a qualification, and that is the economy means different things to different people, right? For economists writ large, we talk about GDP growth. To most people, wages and jobs are the economy. So taking wages and jobs, in the 19 months since Donald Trump took office, we've created 3.6 million jobs. In the final 19 months of Obama's term, 4.6 million jobs were added to the economy. So if you think it's the economy is about jobs added, Obama did better. But there are other things. GDP growth is a little faster right now than it was under Obama. So it's kind of a – it's not generally a good comparison, but if one had to get down to brass tacks, more happened under Obama in an equal amount of time than has happened under Trump.
But isn't it also true that we are seeing a really strong economy now? And what can he claim credit for? I mean, yes, if economists say that it started – under Obama, what can Trump claim credit for?
So if you go back to March 9th of 2009, that was really the day in which the stock market hit its bottom and it started to go up. And if you draw the line from then till now, the trajectory is pretty even. I would say that Donald Trump's election did unleash some so-called animal spirits, right? It got a whole bunch of people to invest more in the stock market, and the stock market has done well. The tax cuts, particularly as they affected people who had assets, have done well for them. But ultimately, history will show that in the last 10 years, the real reason the stock market is up is because of low interest rates, right? It's the only game in town. So that's part of what it is. I think it's fair to say that the economy has not done more poorly under Donald Trump. That's the claim he can make. And there are certainly economic things he can point to say they've happened on his watch. The question is, to whom do you attribute these successes?
Yeah. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. 14 seconds. Does this matter outside of politics?
No, it matters inside of politics only.
Ali, thank you.
All right.
I'm broadcasting from Springfield, Illinois today as part of our election road trip. And joining me here in the studio is Sean Crawford, who is news director here at WUIS. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Jeremy.
And there is a big governor's race in this state. Funnily enough, two very, very rich men running against each other. Bruce Rauner, who's the current governor, the Republican, a multimillionaire, and J.B. Pritzker of the Pritzker family, the Hyatt Hotel Pritzker family, Democrat, a billionaire.
That's right. And we're starting to see evidence of just how wealthy these individuals are. We've been seeing campaign ads going on from the primary elections, which started really last summer, all the way until now. And most of these ads have been negative between both of these candidates.
And Governor Rauner is known for this big budget impasse that happened. Illinois didn't have a budget for 3 years because he didn't want to raise taxes and the legislature didn't want to cut. How did that play out, and did anybody win from that impasse, which eventually ended?
Well, I can't say anybody won. In fact, if anything, you may say that Bruce Rauner may have lost the most because he is the one on the statewide ballot. And yes, the budget impasse, what I think is missed by that is not having a budget did not mean the state of Illinois was not spending money. The state of Illinois continued to spend at a higher rate, like it had a tax increase in place, which actually had expired. And the bills kept piling up. And when Bruce Rauner entered, the state was not in great fiscal shape. Now the state is even in worse fiscal shape, and that's a challenge he faces as he tries to run for election. I should mention that the legislature is controlled by Democrats,
right,
and he is a Republican.
Right. And how much is that budget impasse playing into this election?
I think it's playing a lot because what it does do, it gives his opponent, J.B. Pritzker, quite a bit of ammunition that here's a guy who couldn't get something done. Now, Bruce Rauner will argue, I'm trying to change the way things have been done in Illinois. Things were not good. That's why I got elected in the first place. I'm trying to make change. The Democrats won't go along with me. So that continues to show up quite a bit. And it is an underlying theme, especially among Pritzker's campaign.
What are the big issues for Illinois voters this year?
I think the biggest issue is still the economy and the future of the economy. Our unemployment rate is relatively low.
It's about 4.2% at
last
check.
But at the same time, there seems to be this feeling, this malaise, I think, that's in the state of Illinois. The state has had two governors since the 2000, in the 2000s, that have gone to prison.
Right.
One is still in prison. So there's a lot of mistrust among government. There's a feeling as though taxes are too high, especially when it comes to property taxes. The state is losing population. And overall, there just seems to be an unhappiness out there. I think that's what allowed Bruce Rauner to get into office in the first place. And now, unless you know, things change a lot among people's minds. Now he's a reason possibly that they're going to look to somebody else.
There are also 18 congressional districts in this state. 11 of them, I think, are held by Democrats right now. But we focused on one right here in this area, the 13th district, that is competitive this year. Do you expect that in the midterm elections that we may see some districts flip?
I think it's very possible. Not only this 13th district, there is a race that is in southern Illinois, captures part of the metro east area of St. Louis on the Illinois side that has Representative Mike Bost running there, the incumbent. There's a couple of races in Chicago suburbs that also are rather tight. Anything is possible. I think it all depends on turnout. It is what you would call a blue state, Illinois is, and Democrats overall do tend to do pretty well here, except for a few certain pockets. At the same time, Donald Trump, not very popular. Women are likely to come out, as we've talked about before, and vote in some big numbers this year. So, yeah, anything is possible. So I think it has put the national Republicans looking at Illinois and some of these seats they thought were safe back in play.
We heard something interesting from a woman here in Springfield. Her name is Marilyn Mueller, and she's talking here about President Trump. Let's listen.
I've said this about him since he was elected. My main complaint about Trump is that he brings out the worst in people. You know, I'm a pretty nice person, but he's brought out the worst in me, I have to say.
You know, you and I were at an event last night here in Springfield, heard from a lot of voters here, and this is one of the things that they said, that they think that the tenor of the politics right now is really ugly.
Yeah, I think most people want to see, they want to elect people to go in. They want change, of course, but they want to see people work together. And that's usually, I think, what is always on voters' minds. They want to see government function. And both here in Illinois and at the national level, there are some questions of how well things are functioning. That will certainly play on voters' minds.
Sean, stand by. I want to bring in Nyla Boodoo, who has hosted the show The 21st on Illinois Public Media. She is with us from WILL, my old station in Urbana. Hi, Nyla.
Hi, Jeremy. Welcome back to Illinois.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. And I want to ask you about President Obama, because just the other day, he was there where you are in Urbana at the University of Illinois, kind of entering the campaign fray for the first time this year, speaking to students. And he told them they're coming of age during a backlash against progress. Let's listen.
It did not start with Donald Trump. He is a symptom, not the cause. He's just capitalizing on resentments that politicians have been fanning for years.
Well, Obama then went on to campaign in California over the weekend. He's going to be in Ohio this week. How is his reentry into the campaign fray playing with Illinois voters, do you think?
I think particularly for the students, Jeremy, they were very excited to see President Obama. Almost half of the student body tried to get tickets to President Obama's speech. They only awarded about 1,200 or so. And so the students who made it in were very excited. They had a viewing party that not as many students went to, but we had a student who was there who said he hadn't really thought he had registered to vote, but President Obama had really convinced him and he was going to get out and vote for the next election. So it will be interesting, especially with younger people. People in town were very excited by President Obama's trip to Cafe Paradiso, a coffee shop in Urbana, after his speech. And lots of folks, you know, they stood up and gave him a standing ovation. I think he energized a lot of people, I think, in the Champaign area, certainly among Democratic voters.
What about President Trump? What are you finding about how his popularity is in this state this year?
I think when you look at the 2016 election and you look at where President Trump has support, I think it's really a rural and urban divide. So it's not just Chicago, but if you look at the districts that went for Hillary Clinton, Sean mentioned the 12th congressional district, East St. Louis, where Brendan Kelly is from, that went for Hillary Clinton. SIU in Carbondale, that county went for Hillary Clinton. Champaign-Urbana, here, home of the University of Illinois, also went for Hillary Clinton. So basically, in all of the big cities, Peoria, Rockford, Chicago, basically everywhere but Springfield, voted for Hillary Clinton. And then it's all of those rural areas that were very red.
I want to ask you about one other thing, Nyla, and that is Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago. He just announced that he is not going to run for re-election. We asked J.B. Pritzker, the Democrat running for governor, what he thought of Rahm Emanuel as mayor, whether he thought he's been a good mayor, and he didn't exactly answer the question, but what are your thoughts on that and how that plays into the midterm elections?
Well, the joke in Chicago right now is the people who say they aren't running is actually what reporters are tweeting, because there's so many people now who have thrown their name in. There were about a dozen people who were already in the race before the announcement, and I think now Mayor Emanuel really shocked everyone with this announcement last week that he wasn't going to be running. So I think the question is how this changes the race will be a very interesting one. I think that lots of people now, there are lots of potential women who are now thinking about running, including one of the people who've opened an exploratory committee is Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, a very prominent African-American politician in Chicago. So I think everyone is seeing a wide open race now for Chicago.
Okay, I just want to ask you each one more question, which is there a story in Illinois that's of national importance that you think is not getting enough attention? I'll start with you, Nyla.
I think an interesting story is Illinois and our election system. And I think what people have missed is that in 2016, some voter data was hacked by Russian agents. I think the Illinois State Board of Elections has been very open about what happened. 76,000 voters had information compromised. They've reached out to them, and they've been very open, particularly in the lead up to the election, that they feel like that error happened because of an error of theirs, and that the system is safe, and they want people to go out and vote.
Sean?
Well, I think Illinois is just indicative of what we're seeing in some other states with population loss. We're losing population in the state. Kids are going out of state to attend school. They're not coming back. We're finding that more and more. That's a concern for a state that has a lot of needs, like the state of Illinois, infrastructure and pension debt, things of that sort. Who's going to pay for that going forward?
Sean Crawford, news director here at WUIS in Springfield. We've also been speaking with Nyla Boodoo, host of The 21st at WILL in Urbana. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So all that delicious fruit of the summer season is still flowing. What to do with it? Well, here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has an idea. How about switching from desserts, you know, strawberries on ice cream, to savory dishes? She joins us in the studio. And Kathy, the smells that we're getting right now are savory, but I'm looking at fruit.
You are. You're looking at savory and fruit, which usually is not on the same plate in my house.
Yeah.
I actually decided to challenge myself because, big reveal here, I don't really like fruit and savory food.
What?
So why am I doing this, right? if you take me somewhere and serve me a salad that has blueberries or blackberries on it, I'm running away.
Really?
Turns me off. So I thought there's got to be a way to embrace fruit and savory foods that's going to be really appealing. And I think I came up with some pretty interesting stuff.
We're not shocked. Let's start with the salad. It's a bean salad.
So those are beans, still beans in the garden, still beans in farmer's market. And I thought beans have this great crispy, crunchy. I wanted something juicy and slightly sweet. So I found a very ripe plum, thinly sliced it. Steamed the beans and then made a very gingery dressing for it. Mm. And I think it is so light and refreshing. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I think maybe I like fruit with savory foods.
Not only that, this plum, usually the skin makes me, you know, it's so tart. What'd you do with the plum?
Absolutely nothing.
No.
No, nothing. I just really chose well and got a very ripe one. And the ginger and the beans, it almost feels like a Japanese flavor profile. And then with that plum, it really did remind me of sort of a combination of several favorite Asian dishes.
This one, and you got a nasturtium flower in there, too.
Always. Yeah. A little pretty, but great textures and great colors.
Okay, so here we have a bowl of, it looks like fruit and syrup.
It is salsa.
Okay. But salsa.
It's salsa, but it's been sitting, so it's really let off some juice. You're going to taste some lime in there. It's pitted cherries.
And onions.
There's onions. It's sweet and savory. There's plum, cherries, tomatoes, little bit of onion, lime juice, and jalapeno, and just a dash of scallion and olive oil. And you serve that with some grilled chicken or grilled shrimp or just with taco chips. And suddenly it's really, like, I don't even know what to call that. Is it sweet? Is it savory?
I don't know.
Isn't it refreshing?
It's got kick, too.
The jalapeno. It's like, I just want to eat it with a soup spoon.
Well, let's do that, shall we, after the segment? We'll go wild. But, you know, when you say you don't like as much fruit in savory, I always think of, I like putting fruit on fish, cheese and fruit. So there is that. But staying with that cheese and fruit.
Yes. I always serve fresh fruit and dried fruit with a cheese platter.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about how well fruit goes with cheese, and I thought, what if we did grilled cheese with the end of the summer fruit? So you have what you have before you are two different variations of a grilled cheese. In your hand is my favorite. It's a grilled blue cheese and pitted cherry.
Oh, my.
I know. Is that a wild, fabulous combination, if I do say so? I'm just waiting for you to get like that bite of the tang of the blue cheese with the sweetness of the cherry and the juiciness of it. Mm. It completely redefines grilled cheese.
I love blue cheese and like apples in a salad.
Yes.
This. Every now and then you bring something, Kathy, that's like, oh, this is my favorite taste out of it. This is amazing.
That's how I've been feeling about blue cheese. And the cherries this year have been remarkable.
Okay.
So then I thought, okay, what else? So I took a peach and I cut the peach in half, took the pit out, threw it on my grill, got my grill very hot, took out a rack, put the peaches down. And when I turned them over, I grilled them for about 3 minutes per side. I basted them with some maple syrup. So you have a grilled maple scented peach. Thinly sliced that and paired it with sharp cheddar cheese, and that's what your second grilled cheese sandwich is.
And this should win a Nobel.
I think so,
too.
So
how do you, I mean, how do you...
Do they give Nobels for grilled cheese? They should.
How does that happen? A peach and maple syrup?
Because I'll tell you why. The peaches from my trees were not quite as sweet as I wanted. And I thought, oh, I could drizzle honey on this. But maple and cheddar, it's like the beginning of fall, those flavors that you crave. Then I started thinking, what about blueberry Gruyere? What about raspberry feta? And how much fun would it be to sort of have a party and serve five different types of grilled cheese and fruit sandwiches? With that salsa?
With the salsa, with the beans.
Now, the thing that I realized, Robin, is that we love sweetness in savory foods. Think of the most basic, ketchup on a hamburger. What is ketchup? It's
sugar.
Tomatoes and sugar.
Right.
So many of the sauces and condiments that we use are loaded with sugar. So why not have the natural sweetness of fruit do the job?
Cranberry sauce and turkey.
There you go, number one.
So think of your end of summer fruit as something to put next to something savory.
It kind of opens things up.
Yeah.
You know, don't stop making those fruit pies and don't stop, you know, adding fruit to cakes and tarts. But boy, it was a real eye-opener for me. I embrace it.
And Kathy Gunst, a recipes for savory uses for summer fruit. We'll have it all at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And the internet will break. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at WUIS in Springfield. We want to say thanks to General Manager Randy Eccles, News Director Sean Crawford, Director of Development Nijay Bogdanovich, Reporter Rachel Otwell, and Engineer Greg Manfroy. Now it's on to Indianapolis, where we'll be at WFYI on Thursday. Tune in. This is Here and Now.